You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
All right, guys, it's CPI day. CPI data, consumer price index data, came out this morning. It was hotter than expected, and the market reacted negatively to that because basically the market was hoping that we were going to get some Fed cuts in June, and a total of three this year. And basically, now that the economy is running hotter than the market was expecting, the market's pricing in that we're going to get two Fed cuts. It's pretty crazy to think about that. 5 or 6 months ago, the market was really flying on expectations that we were going to have like six rate cuts this year. And now it looks like we may only have two or potentially
maybe
less.
Maybe even one.
But we're still very close to all-time highs. Markets opened down like 1.5% or something like that. I don't know where they're at right now, but it's close to 1% down. Basically, any sort of risk asset was trading off. I really like to look at the dynamics that exist on days like today. So the U.S. dollar is strengthened, and so the euro is down, basically. There's just a flight to safety on days like today. Bitcoin down 5.5%. That's just a speculative asset, essentially, is what that's become. It's not really an inflation hedge, because obviously inflation's up today, but Bitcoin is down significantly. Yields on treasuries increased to their highest since November. The 10-year treasury is at like 4.5% now. And that was basically across the board. On the short end of the spectrum, yields are way up.
It used to be that the 10-year treasury was the flight to safety, and that has really changed in the last couple of years with the very sensitive component of interest rates to price of bonds. And the safety asset has been the dollar. I mean, anytime that you see the dollar strengthening, it's been negative for risk assets. And we're seeing that today. The dollar's been weakening since November. I remember when the euro was at parity or even below the dollar. This was like summer of 2022. I was talking with a client today who spends time in England, and she was saying just how crazy it was. We bought some sterling, some British pounds at, it was like $1.10 for one British pound. Now it's, it was yesterday, it was $1.27. And so a weakening US dollar is positive from the perspective of people are selling dollars and buying risk assets. And I think the alternative is true, that when things get a little bit hairy, it's not the treasuries that rally, it's the dollar.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. And so you made a prediction at the beginning of the year that we're going to have some return to the negative correlation between stocks and treasury yields. So we'll see what
any day that correlation turns positive, you bring it up. But it's actually worked so far this year,
right? Yeah,
stocks are way up and bonds are down,
right? So we'll see. But today's not the day. Your prediction's not working today. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. The actual fundamentals of inflation, like if you look at the real-time indicators, trueflation is at 1.82%. That's a unbiased resource that provides a real-time impression of inflation. Of course, the Fed looks at consumer price index, which one of the biggest factors is a thing called owner's equivalent rent, OER, which basically says that's basically pushing the inflationary numbers higher. Although if you look at the actual rents themselves, they're coming down. So in any event, the Fed is looking at this data and saying that they're not going to cut rates as quickly, or the market's looking at this data and saying the Fed is not going to cut rates as quickly as they anticipated, which then increases the likelihood that they're going to have an unforced error. So that's really the sort of unknown that's going on in the marketplace, and that's why the market's reacting negatively today. The other sort of wild card that exists is the U.S. presidential elections are in November of this year, and the question is, well, is the Fed going to cut rates in the month or two before then? The issue with that is that they risk looking like they're trying to boost one party or the other. So there's a lot of prognostication that they may even hold their hold steady basically until after the presidential elections. So a lot to be seen on, or a lot remains to be seen as it relates to what the Fed is going to do. Never a dull moment, but the markets are reacting negatively. Doug, what else do you have on your list as far as things that are going on? We got this.
Well, one piece of CPI that we didn't mention, which was a major increase, was the transportation component was up like 10% year over year, and is a big piece of the month over month increase in CPI. And included in that is cost of vehicle transportation, cost of insurance. That's the real big piece that has to get figured out. I mean, if you live anywhere coastal, you see, I mean, this is not transportation, but you understand that the implication of higher insurance costs on the ability to afford a house, the ability to afford a car, and there's got to be some sort of reform in the insurance business to bring these rates down, because it's just ridiculous how expensive it is to insure oneself, whether it's a vehicle insurance or homeowners insurance. I think
it's so crazy about as it relates to homeowners insurance policies. New policies now, I just got a homeowners policy quote that showed that for the major risk that we face in New Orleans is a hurricane and damage resulting from a hurricane. The issue that I have with regards to my homeowners insurance quote is specifically that it basically would have to be an event that caused 10% of the value of my home to go away for there'd be a claim. So it'd have to be a cataclysmic type of event, not just damage to my roof or whatever. That basically wouldn't be covered. It'd have to be something cataclysmic, which is super unlikely. And my premiums are going up, so that makes no sense for me to have that insurance really, unless I have one of those horrendous events, which is it's cost prohibitive for me to get that insurance.
Yeah, and the lenders require insurance, so it's not like you can say, "Look, I'm gonna." If you have any sort of mortgage, you have to have an insurance component that at least recovers the lender's portion of the note, and so, or the value of the house. So it's basically everybody's got to have insurance that owns a home, unless you own your home outright, and even then, people are. Or would rather be insured than uninsured, but it's just becoming unattainable. So that's something, inflationary that I think a lot of that is also regulatory. These states, a lot of states mandate, that insurance companies take on certain, types of uninsurable type people. I mean, they limit competition. And so I think that the insurance companies, in order for them to come back to market, especially for a homeowner's perspective, needs to be a little bit more of a competitive environment versus heightened a high regulatory environment. Anyway, and I think that piece, in order to be able to afford to live in any sort of coastal area, along with high interest rates and high materials costs since COVID, and high labor costs because it's hard to find people. Those things are all adding up and making it difficult to afford to buy a car, because the supply chain issues on car manufacturing, or hard to find spare parts, but also in a home. And so as inflation is coming down, it doesn't mean it goes back to prices don't go back to where they were in 2019. Just the rate of change goes down, and hopefully to a level that's more stable. But some of these entrenched issues, like cost of insurance, wage increases that are typically sticky, commodity prices that are going up. We see oil in the mid-80s, and if tensions in the Middle East and Russia continue to escalate, then it's hard to see that reversing. Those are things to look out for, and I think that's what the market is seeing as scary in this print from today, which is 0.4% month over month versus the expected 0.3%. I still am a firm believer, and if you look at trueflation, you're saying, look, let's look at this from a purely agnostic perspective. If you look at real-time data, it does show that inflation is where the Fed's target is, but you do get these very volatile days like you have today, in which you expect, or you have some sort of expectation that inflation is re-entrenched and you have a fear that goes alongside with that. And that's what the Fed's looking at. That's what the market's looking at. And assets are getting repriced as a result. I mean, I just looked at the VNQ, which is Vanguard's REIT index, which is down almost 5% today. Why is that? Because real estate is a highly levered asset class and is sensitive to interest rates. The real estate sector is starving for cuts. I mean, if you look at anywhere else in the world besides real estate, it doesn't really matter right now. You've got people that have locked in low interest rate debt or they're underlevered. I'm going to talk about it in a second, how the private sector is a really good financial shape. Then you look on the other side of the equation. We talked to Seth Johnson about this. The real estate market, I think they would rather a recession that puts rates back to, you know, 1 or 2% than strong economic growth with strong rent increases, but the same interest rates. I bet the real estate sector would say, just give me a recession so I can get rates back down versus a no landing scenario.
Right. Because they're just basically like survive or treading water or whatever based upon that sort of a dynamic with interest rates being sticky and high and everything. Yeah, so it's a really interesting environment that's going on right now. I want to shift gears. We talked about the presidential election coming up. A couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump's SPAC, DJT, which is Truth Social, came out, and it was like essentially like a meme stock. It priced at $6.25 billion at its peak. It IPO'd at $2.86 billion. So it was up like 100% in a day or whatever. That's something that was reminiscent of like the GameStop days. And now that
it's like all these like meme coins are going crazy, like the Solana and all this crap that was commonplace in 2021. We were talking about this a few weeks ago that it was feeling a little bit speculative because all of these Reddit investors were coming out of the woodworks and jumping into, you know, crypto again. They're jumping into SPACs. And so, you know, the market's off 1% today. It's basically choppy over the last, let me look at Morningstar last month, it really hasn't done much of anything.
I saw a picture of a guy in a, like working at a mall kiosk with a Bitcoin price chart on his computer. So yeah, there's just all these videos of people talking with their Uber drivers about cryptocurrency and stuff. So you definitely read about it.
We need a break. And I think that, you know, today's not really any representation of what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. If this is the start of some sort of sustained correction or, you know, blip, but you know, if you look at where this U.S. stock market is today, you've got the Dow and the S&P, which are both off 1%. The Russell 2000, which is small caps, is off almost 3% today. Just a major sell-off in risk assets. And then you have the 10-year treasury, which started the day at like 4.38%, is now 4.55%. So stocks and bonds getting crushed, real estate getting crushed. The only thing that's saving you today is, and gold's off 0.5%. The only thing saving you today is the U.S. dollar, which you know, is just representative of a flight to safety. And you may get a few more days of this, or it may be just a blip in the radar and we just continue on from here.
Yeah. The other thing that's kind of holding up well is energy as well too. And specifically the price of a barrel of oil got up to $86, but a lot of that's on geopolitical concerns. There is a report that came out earlier today that this is Bloomberg citing sources within the government that there's an impending missile strike from Iran onto Israel. And so that's holding up. But you're right. Basically everything is selling off today, anything that's associated with any sort of speculation. And that's even more magnified in Bitcoin, like we talked about previously, that's just a speculative asset. And any sort of other cryptocurrency, I'm sure if you looked at all the other cryptocurrencies, that's even more magnified the further on the speculation spectrum you go. DJT, which is Truth Social stock, is just another example of that. Who knows what that business is going to become, but as of its latest earnings report, it had something like $5 million of revenue, and it was at its peak after it had IPO'd, was trading at $6 billion. So there's really not any fundamental basis.
I don't even know if people are trying to make money off of that. I mean, I think that it's purely for the people that are invested. I think there's two types of investors in DJT. I think there's the one investor that's saying, look, I'm going to catch this momentum wave and hopefully be able to buy it for, you know, $1 and sell it for $2 later. The other people are like, they're basically protesting with their investment. That's how I view this, is like, I don't care if I lose money on this, but I'm going to basically try to help out Donald Trump through his ownership in this particular company. That's how I view that particular stock. And but I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I think if you're looking at it from the pure investment perspective, an $8 billion company with $5 million in revenues that's having a cash issues. They came out the past week with a press release on that. And I can't imagine that that's going to work out for somebody in the long run that's thinking that's going to be worth more than $8 billion when all is said and done.
Yeah. And a company with $5 million of revenue, just to put that into perspective, is like a moderately successful restaurant. So that's just such a small company that's trading at such a gigantic, from a revenue standpoint, that's trading at such a gigantic valuation, and certainly doesn't have any sort of fundamental basis to it. But you're right. I think it's people that are supporting their guy, or people that are trying to just make money on any sort of speculation, even though there's no fundamental value, just like buying Dogecoin or something like that, or buying the Joe Biden cryptocurrency, which is one of the, or Donald Trump cryptocurrency, same sort of thing, essentially. So one of the things that I found, we've talked about this at length, it's really interesting, is a sort of the fall off in electric vehicles. Over the last week, since we talked about this last week, Ford announced that they're no longer going to produce any more purely electric vehicles, and they're going to shift their strategy to hybrids. Used Teslas are at like an all-time low. Tesla is the worst performing stock in the S&P 500 this year, which is crazy, because at one point in time, that was riding the same sort of waves as a lot of meme stocks, and people made a tremendous amount of money betting on Tesla. There was a huge contingent of people that are shorting Tesla that lost a ton of money. Very smart, famous investors in that same cohort. This is a quote from Charlie Bellello. Used Teslas are so cheap right now that it's hard not to buy one. And what is the fundamental driver for prices collapsing? And number two, would you buy a Tesla with 40,000 miles on it? At one point in time, used Teslas on average in October of 2022 were $68,000 per used Tesla. You can buy a used Tesla now for $31,000 on average.
That's great for, you know, we were talking about inflation earlier. That's great for affordability of cars, and especially if these are more efficient from a cost perspective to recharge, then I think, you know, cheaper used cars is definitely better. Elon Musk came out in the last week and said that Tesla, he expects at some point this year or next to have its chat GPT moment, basically, that where full self-driving becomes a reality. If that's the case, it would be such a game changer for just everyday life and transportation. And I'm hoping that it happens. He's been talking about it for years, and so we'll see if it actually comes to fruition. But I think that would be just a frontier. That would be such a productivity boost for people. It would be much better how we can design streets, without a need for parking, if you had full self-driving and autonomous driving. And so we'll see if Tesla can conquer that particular obstacle that's been eluding really smart people for a long period of time. I want to come back to really the economy here for a second, because I found this thread really interesting. This is from Alfonso Pecatiello, who's a macroeconomist based in Italy, and he writes for a organization called the Macro Compass. And basically the question mark is, and I think this was consensus in 2022, that the world, but specifically the United States, couldn't handle higher interest rates. How is it that the Federal Reserve went on this high, excessive hiking cycle, went from 0% interest rates to 5.5% interest rates in the fastest period of time, when seemingly the world is drowning in debt, when those debt payments go up substantially, you would imagine that puts a crunch on everywhere else. So how is it possible that we could have a no landing economic situation, meaning that we don't have a recession when interest rates change so dramatically? And so this is really a good thesis on what's actually happening underneath the hood as a with respect to changes in interest rates and a slowdown in the economy. This is what Alfonso says. He said the Fed hiked rates above 5%, and yet the U.S. economy doesn't break. He then says high interest rates are supposed to break something because an overly indebted economy will have to service a mountain of debt at expensive rates, and it'll have less money for income and spending. The problem is that people are looking at the wrong debt. Private sector debts, debt levels and trends are by far more important than government debt. So this is his thesis. Contrary to the government, the private sector doesn't have the luxury to print money. If you get indebted to your eyeballs and you use your ability to generate income, the pain is real. As Daria Perkins' chart shows, which is a chart here, the biggest financial crisis happened as a result of high and growing private sector debt. The Japanese and Spanish housing bubble bursting, the Asian tigers, the China today are all clear examples. So he has a chart here with Japan, Thailand, Spain, and China. Private sector credit as a percent of GDP growing, and then that bubble bursting in the early 90s in Japan, in the late 90s in Thailand, in the early 2010s in Spain, and then occurring now in China. History showed over and over again that the levels and trends in the private sector debt offer much better hints about leverage and vulnerabilities than government debt. So what are the countries with the highest private sector debt to GDP and with the worst trends over the last 10 years? And he just goes through a bunch of European countries and Asian countries here. But more importantly, he talks about private sector debt in the United States. He says in late 2007, the housing market cracked under the pressure of excessive private sector leverage. Today, the story is different. Scale of government deficits in orange in this chart in 2020 and 2021 is enormous, but private sector credit in blue is not roaring. We're actually way below where we were in 2007 from a private sector credit as a percent of GDP. And so this goes back to contrary to the original argument in 2022, if the Fed hikes rates, the economy will break. Well, what wasn't considered was that the private sector individuals and companies had really great balance sheets, and those balance sheets have withstood this rate hiking cycle better than anybody expected. And I think if we have to keep rates at this high, yes, you risk a lot of those debts rolling over into higher rates. People that fixed rates at low interest rates then have to refinance at higher interest rates. But we're still on a relatively basis well below leverage levels that we saw in the mid-2000s. And I think that if rates have to stay at this level for longer, you're going to have certain sectors of the economy that are struggling. But from an aggregate perspective, the consumer and companies are in really great shape.
You're absolutely right. And if that any sort of unanticipated thing happens regarding some aspect of the economy breaking as a result of the Fed's actions and keeping rates higher for longer, then that causes some market sell-off or what have you. That would be totally normal and something that we would anticipate. We've talked about this before, but if you look back at history, you get like a 5% correction a couple times a year. 10% happens about once a year on average. 20% happens every 2 or 3 years. 30% happens every 5 years. And you get a 50% every once in a generation. So it wouldn't be any surprise that this is, the Fed obviously has navigated this whole situation really well, and that we've got a really strong economy. Even in spite of the fact that we had one of the highest rate increase cycles in history, or the highest rate increase cycle in history, going from basically nothing to 5.5% where we are now. And rates are going to stay higher for longer is the sort of moral of the story as it relates to what happened today. But if we do have some sort of unanticipated thing happen and it causes markets to sell off, it's been a really nice run. And that's just almost a necessary evil in terms of market action. I don't know. What's your take on that, Doug?
Well, I think the, I see the other side to that is that now we have room to be able to be a lot more accommodative if we run into
You're absolutely right.
a stalled economy. We have rate. We were in a position a couple of years ago where we couldn't cut rates. The rates were already at 0%. And so now we're at 5%. You have wiggle room to, number one, cut rates. Number two, expand the balance sheet, even though that's definitely something that we need to get back into parity on the Fed's balance sheet. But they've been raising rates, and they've been letting maturities roll off on they've been going through quantitative tightening. And so both of those can be reversed. I don't know if there's certain sectors and individuals and of political ideologies that don't want that. But yeah, I think you have a lot more wiggle room to be accommodative in the event that we run into a bear market and economic drawdown. And I think that there is definitely a silver lining to where we are from a Fed policy perspective today.
Yep. So I want to point to one thing from a society observation standpoint. This is from the Financial Times, and then we can close the podcast unless you have something else to add. So, but this is per the Financial Times. And I was thinking about this last night as I saw a lot of little girls at soccer practice. My daughter is involved in travel soccer, and there's a tremendous amount of little girls involved in that. But this is from the Financial Times. Parenting time has become far more intensive in most developing countries. And this goes on to say, average number of hours per day mothers spend doing hands-on parenting. And basically across the board, Korea is the biggest increase. They're famous for their tiger mothers or whatever, but going on from basically a half hour a day in the 1960s to 4 hours a day of parenting, hands-on parenting from mothers. And then that basically exists in the United States as well, too. But the most interesting observation was is that in France, it's the only country surveyed out of all of them that parenting time has decreased. So I think
the Bebe book,
right, that bringing up
was,
Bebe.
Yeah, bringing up Bebe right. is basically like, don't pay attention to your kids and just do what you want.
Right.
And,
but that's borne out in the data. And, but yeah, I mean, I don't know if you look at the, if you did a juxtaposition of this, the amount of time people spend parenting their kids and the overall happiness of children in the United States, I'm sure those two things are negatively correlated. But in any event, Doug, do you have anything else to add, or should we leave it there?
We hope everybody has a great weekend. I'll be watching the Masters and rooting for Tiger Woods and hoping that he can pull a rabbit out of his hat. But
who's your pick, Doug?
Who's my real pick, or who do I?
Yeah.
Yeah. My real pick is, I think Xander Schauffele and Wyndham Clark are the top two guys that probably are playing the best golf right now. And so we'll see how they do, other than Scottie Scheffler, who's the clear favorite. But I'm just saying people behind Scottie. And then I just want Tiger to win just because I love him. And I grew up.
Is that a real possibility?
No.
No. I mean, can he even walk?
Yeah, yeah. He actually played in the practice round this week and supposedly played great, and so we'll see.
Okay, great. All right, I'll be rooting for Tiger as well, too, and it should be a fun golf event. But if you guys enjoy this podcast, please give us 5 stars, share with your friends and family, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.